This is Larry McClellan talking about Not My Neighborhood, an introductory discussion and presentation on housing discrimination. And I've discovered that part of the crew are Chicago people, so I'll be able to, I will try to pepper what I say with some Chicago examples. I've lived in the suburbs south of Chicago for 17 years. For 16 years of those, I was on the faculty at Governor State University teaching sociology and community studies. And this past January, I left the university after 16 years to become pastor of St. Paul Community Church in Homewood, which is a United Church of Christ congregation. So I'm here as an outsider watching how Lutherans talk to each other. What I'd like to do this evening is to outline, if you will, in kind of a headline fashion, some basic ideas and ways of understanding issues related to housing discrimination. And this, like many other things, are incredibly complex. And those of you from Chicago and other cities know how monstrously complex all of this gets. There is a real web of racial and economic kinds of elements that all flow together. What I'm doing is kind of pulling out of those a very important stream, that stream having to do with housing discrimination. And I hope that by presenting a set of ideas, then we'll have some time to talk about it. I really want to challenge a couple basic assumptions that we all carry, and that are assumptions that are carried particularly by white Americans, and that is that somehow or another, the segregation that we have in our society is in large part a result of free choice. One of the most common things that when people start talking about blacks and whites in their housing patterns is the notion that, well, blacks and whites just kind of naturally live in different places or want to live in different places. And for some whites and some blacks, that is true. But for many, many, many black families, their housing choices are a result of a very strong pattern of very nasty discriminatory practices. And I want to outline some of that so that you have some handles on some of the stuff that goes on when we talk about controversies in terms of housing patterns. So let me I'll go through a set of general observations, and then I want to talk specifically about our rather sad history of discrimination in housing. And then let's talk about all of it. Most of us in American society have operated, when we talk about where do people live, where do they settle, we have operated out of a kind of an expansion notion. There's always more, it's always better. Our cities get bigger, we move to the west, we move to the suburbs, there's always opportunity. And that's a very powerful model for most of us, that we really do have freedom of movement in this society. Unfortunately, that notion is very true for white families in our society, but historically has not been true for black families or other minority families. And in point of fact, we have, in that expansion kind of model, we really do have a dark side. A dark side that has given us a very extensive and lengthy history of various kinds of exclusion, various kinds of segregatory practices, not only against blacks, but against almost any other minority that you could mention. And for some of the minorities in our society, those kinds of practices continue to operate against them. And that's what I want to get to. The dilemma in talking about whites and blacks is that whites have operated under this kind of expansion model of having the widest possible choice, and historically, blacks have operated under a contraction model. In fact, over the last 80 years, housing opportunities for blacks has become very much hemmed in until we got into the 1960s and 70s, and that's part of the story I want to talk about. But first big point is there have been massive discriminatory practices in housing. Second big point is the practices in housing are related to lots of other things in terms of economics, social change, employment patterns, all kinds of stuff. So remember that I'm just taking one stream out of a very complex picture. One of the things I always think about when I try to remember the complexity of this is the fact that in Chicago there are several places that are held up as kind of models, success stories, where blacks and whites have been living together for a number of years. And one of the places that people point to is Hyde Park. But to reflect the complexity of that, some of you remember the old Mike Nichols and Elaine May from years ago. They had a wonderful line about Hyde Park. What's Hyde Park? Hyde Park is the place where black people and white people stand shoulder to shoulder against the poor. And in fact, that's what happened to Hyde Park. You know, Hyde Park has been successful racially because they got rid of all the poor people. And so, you know, that just is, you know, that's how it gets complex, because the racial stuff intersects with the economic stuff. There would be some people that would maintain that the crunch issue for all of us is an economic issue. You know, how do we get the classes to integrate or work together? I think I tend to be somewhat to the other side, suggesting that I think for our society, the crunch issue may be the racial question. Because what we have had for 300 years is the evolution of a white society and the evolution of a black society, and the ways of figuring out how those come together is a fundamental American dilemma. It's a dilemma because today, in the latest national survey, which was done about a year and a half ago, they found that over 85% of the black families surveyed experienced direct discriminatory actions against their search for housing. Discrimination in housing is alive and well, and it is specifically directed against black families. And that's something we've all got to figure out. What does that mean? And then how do we deal with that? Two myths get in the way. One myth is the old American ideal that we are a melting pot, that somehow or another we all are treated the same, we all can kind of come together. I much prefer the image that we are a stew pot. And in some ways, I think a stew pot is a kind of a more exciting image, because you've got all those fragrances and all those different tastes and so on that combine. And yet all the elements that are in the stew together, they become kind of parts of each other, but they also have some individuality. And one of the myths we have to deal with is the fact that we are not a melting pot, that in fact our experiences are profoundly different than other people's experiences. The second myth that I would want to challenge, I've already alluded to, and that is the myth of free choice. That because of the stew pot, there are some of us in this society that really have had a free choice in terms of our housing and settlement. Lots of other folks have not had free choices. Now, I'm going to be focusing specifically on conditions for black families, but these things apply to other minority groups also. There have been, for black families, an interlocking of three basic dynamics. First of all, and again, I'm generalizing because it'd take us 5 hours to do all of this. First of all, there is the ongoing human problem of basic racial prejudice that all of us have had to struggle with, that has in our society been particularly directed against blacks. Secondly, there is a very, very extensive pattern of institutional behavior which has been directed specifically against black families and their housing choices. And thirdly, from the 1920s through the 1960s, the basic policies of the federal government were actively supportive of segregation in housing. And that, combined with the institutional practices, have caused a lot of our problems. So what I would like to do is to, given those introductory things, take you through some of the history of discrimination in housing and highlight some of the things that you may not be aware of that have contributed to this problem are of people ending up saying, well, not in my neighborhood. For those of you from Chicago, you may know that Chicago was remarkably well integrated up through the turn of the century and up into the 1910s and the 19-teens. There were black families throughout the city of Chicago and the suburban areas, but a couple things started to happen in the 1920s. In the cities of the North, there was this dramatic movement of black families to northern cities, in part because of wartime industry, in part because of the failure of the agricultural stuff. And black families were moving up, and that combined with the kind of prejudice that was directed against blacks. And folks began to look at ways to control black settlement. And some very interesting things started to happen. First of all, well, I'll get to 1917. One of the first things that people in control said, we don't want black people living in our city. But in fact, the industries needed the black. Hello. It's a very, I have a very large mouse. One of the first reactions that white officials in northern cities had was, let's control the settlement of blacks because they're all, you know, more and more black families were moving. Let's control it by creating black zones or black areas, black ghettos within the city. And a number of communities were talking about that. In 1917, the city of Baltimore actually passed a racial zoning law, which said that there's one area of the city that is zoned for black occupancy, and that's where the only place where blacks can live. And you know, that's kind of astonishing to think about. But that was struck down by the courts. And that led a number of other cities to back off from their desire to create, you know, like they used to do in the Middle Ages with Jews and, you know, in European cities. You know, a number of cities then backed off from the creation of zones of occupation for blacks. And they searched around for other kinds of ways to bring this settlement under control. And they created in the early 1920s a thing called the Restrictive Covenant, the Racially Restrictive Covenant. And that was a covenant that was put on the land that said, this land may only be sold to people of the Caucasian race. And in Chicago and in most other northern cities, there was, throughout the 1920s, a very, very active campaign on the part of real estate interests and financial institutions to get as much of the city under racially restrictive covenants as they possibly could as a way to deny access for black families. As you can imagine, this was challenged by black families that said, you know, because I'm black is no reason to deny me housing if I've got the money and everything else. Well, it was taken to the Supreme Court in 1926, and the Supreme Court said that racially restrictive covenants are okay. And racially restrictive covenants were in force in American cities from 1926 until, guess, 1948. You know, over 20 years, there were racially restrictive covenants. And I mean, if you go back, some of you, even if you have your deeds, in my research in the southern suburbs of Chicago, I've gone into the records in Cook County and I've seen the microfilms of the original deeds, and the deeds all say at the bottom, you know, Flossmoor, elite, you know, upper class Flossmoor. Well, I looked at a subdivision in Flossmoor and all the deeds had at the bottom, this house may be sold only to people of Caucasian race. All right, you know, and that was affirmed and upheld by the Supreme Court in 1926. Okay, that was part of what was going on in the 1920s. At the same time, there were the developments, the invention of the real estate industry happened in the 1920s. There had been various kinds of real estate entrepreneurs, subdivision developers, going back into the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. But the creation, if you will,
of the real estate industry itself, with, you know, brokers and agents and people buying and selling real estate, really crystallized in the 1920s. Part of the code of ethics for real estate boards in the 1920s across the country was that they would not sell property to black families except in already black settled areas or immediately adjacent to those areas. That was written into the code of ethics in the 1920s. So like in Chicago, you have right there the piece, the basic building block for what became block busting and panic peddling, where it was put into the code of ethics that you could only sell to black families in this area and to white families in this area, or if you ran out of housing for black families but you had black potential buyers, then you could buy, you could sell houses immediately adjacent. And so the real estate industry hit upon the wonderful phenomenon known as panic peddling, where they would go into communities, they would surreptitiously buy a house on a white street, they would move a black family in, they would go up and down the street and tell all the white families, it's too late, it's all over, the only thing you can do is run away, sell me your house. The whites panic, sell their house for anything they can get. The black families, who are desperate for housing, will pay anything to get a house for their family and their kids. And so, you know, hypothetically, house is worth $20,000, okay? Real estate interests would panic peddle, the whites would panic, they sell their houses for $12,000 to $15,000. Worth 20. Blacks who are desperate for housing because the black area is filled are willing to pay $30,000 for the house. Very much in the interest of the real estate industry to create that kind of chaos. Now that was, and you know, I mean, this is not, I'm not giving you an interpretation. You know, the restrictive covenants were in force. The real estate board codes of ethics were in force starting in the 1920s. And those basic activities continued down through well into the 60s. The restrictive covenants were changed in 48, but that's another story. In the 1930s, the federal government for the first time begins to get involved in housing issues, in housing concerns. The Roosevelt administration forms the Federal Housing Administration, FHA. FHA, one of its first functions had to do with the appraisal of properties. And one in the FHA manual starting in 1934 and kept in the manuals for 12 years. Let me find this. You're going to love this. The manual stressed the importance of, quote, excluding incompatible racial and social groups from housing developments and recommending the use of race-restrictive covenants. Right? Federal manuals, federal policy said, you know, if you want your house, if you want to get a mortgage on your house, what you've got to do is, number one, you use a race-restrictive covenant, and number two, you make sure that your neighborhood is all white. Otherwise, you're not going to get money. And that's a pretty powerful incentive for people who might otherwise say, well, you know, what difference does it make if there's some black people or other people living on the block? But if the FHA comes in and says, you know, if you want to sell your house, that guy can't get a mortgage because there are blacks on your block, you know, all of a sudden your economic interest gets engaged. All right, those are in effect for 12 years. In the 1940s, following the war, families came back. The loan guarantee programs established through FHA and VA were structured in such a way that it was almost impossible for black veterans to get the loans. The loans could only go to whites. The loans were only appropriate for new construction. Builders, after World War II, are looking for new construction. Where do you build new houses? Do you build them in the city? You put them in the suburbs. And if the only people that can get the guaranteed loans to buy all your houses are white, that means that what happens is all these veterans come back, and they all come back to the city, and the blacks are stuck in the city, and the whites all get their new mortgages and move out to the suburbs. You know, now that's
You know, that wasn't a matter of choice. That's a matter of where the money was available. There were two small loan programs available for black veterans, but the numbers were so small that it didn't have, you know, it didn't have effect on the giant pattern.
Okay. So that then begins a process where it almost guarantees the development of post-war suburban subdivisions as all-white subdivisions. And you immediately start having a separation. Okay, in the 1950s, a couple key points, one being the phenomenon of urban renewal, which did a couple, again, I don't want to, it gets so complicated, I'm not doing justice to it. But urban renewal served to eliminate a lot of housing within cities and further concentrate and squeeze the areas of cities where blacks were able to buy housing in the 1950s. And so it further concentrated black settlement in American cities. And with that came the development of what today we refer to as the dual housing market. And that is that there is a systematic pattern that is still very, very prevalent throughout the United States of real estate interests directing, through a whole host of techniques, directing the places where white and black families look for housing, so that white families are directed to look in white areas, black families are directed to look in black areas and integrated areas. And that's the hook. Because those areas which are integrated and have good experiences with integration have great difficulty maintaining their integration, because the real estate industry withdraws the white market and keeps the black market. And so even if there is no panic or no crisis and everybody's very happy, over the course of time in an integrated community, as white families and black families move out and they are only replaced by black families, it segregates into a black community. That's what we call the dual housing market. That's probably the, you know, kind of the greatest issue that we've got contemporarily. But that really comes out of the 1950s. Now, let me say about three more things, and then I want us all to have time to talk about this. Another very, very sad piece of this puzzle, which was federal policy, was what was called the Section 235 Home Purchase Program. Was a program that was developed in the 1960s, laudable program allowing, you know, kind of modest income families to buy their own homes. Okay, there are two basic strategies. If you want to give the potential to modest income people for really having their own homes, and I mean, I'm one of those people that says, you know, if people own their own homes, they take care of them. I mean, that's really important. There are two strategies. One strategy is what's called the ghetto enrichment strategy. That is, you allow the home purchases within the black ghetto so that people are making substantial financial commitments to the area where they already live. Okay? That's one strategy. Another strategy is called the scattered site strategy. And that is to really serve people well, what you ought to do is develop a strategy so that people, minority families, take that 235 money and they go sprinkled throughout the communities out in the suburbs. The notion being that if they're kind of scattered around, that doesn't create any kind of tension or impacting or whatever it is. So, two basic strategies. Say you've got a large black area in your city. The first strategy is, let's put those resources and those home purchasing dollars into where the black families are to really make it a stronger community. The second strategy is instead of doing that, let's design it so that the folks go out into the areas and you know, buy, their housing is developed in other places. What the 235 program did for years throughout the 1960s was that they paid for and developed housing developments, single-family dwellings, on the edges
of black communities.
So that instead of in any way fostering some kind of racial segregation, all it did was expand the ghetto. Okay. Now the argument I want to make for you is that, and this is kind of part one, tomorrow night, or tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to be talking a lot about how do we deal with racial integration, and we'll get into that some tonight too. But the really big thing I want to say tonight is, we have had in this country, from the period of the 1920s well into the 1960s, and we today are still dealing with the consequences and the patterns of this activity, a very systematic set of activities supported by, encouraged, and funded by the federal government that have all served to segregate white families from black families through restrictive covenants, through FHA appraisals, through various kind of urban renewal and other kinds of home development programs. We have had a de facto federal policy that says families are going to be segregated from one another. That's staggering. That's not an issue of free choice. And that has been linked significantly with private sector activity on the part of real estate boards and financial institutions that actively fostered the use of restrictive covenants, that fostered the kind of activities of the FHA, that took advantage of the loan guarantee programs, and participated vigorously in the development of the dual housing market. So the argument I'm laying before you is, when we look at the problem of housing discrimination, there are lots and lots of pieces, but a very important piece is that it has not been a function of free choice. It has not been a function of whites individually saying, I don't want to live with black families, or a black family saying individually, I don't want to live with white families, but rather a host of rather official activities that have separated people from each other. And that's, you know, that's a sad history. Somebody had a question. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, are you with me? Have I missed some pieces?
Now in the last 20 years.
Yes. Yeah, there have been very interesting things happening. And I want to talk about that next chunk. Let me see if we're together on the historical pieces, because you're right. There has been a significant change since the 1960s. Well, that's a very good question. I think the short answer would be that you're on the right track. That evidently it was a mix of motives. There was first of all, you know, in our country we've had a good deal of historical prejudice of whites directed against blacks, just, you know, kind of bigotry. That coupled with a kind of the cultural ethos that had developed in the United States that really were seeing blacks as second-class human beings. And so it was not just individuals being bigoted, but there was also a kind of an ethos that said that, you know, blacks really are second class and we don't want to associate with them. And then there was, thirdly, that economic factor of black families being perceived as, and in many instances experienced as, you know, fresh from the South, low income, you know, don't know what to do with their housing, this kind of stuff. And that kind of automatic equation, if there are black families, they are automatically low-income families. And so we've got to kind of contain them and keep them out of the way. But, of course, you know, by the time you get in the 1920s, you know, Chicago had a very vibrant black middle class. And the problem was, because of the peculiar fact of race, that strong black middle class got lumped in with the perception people had of this kind of lower income groups coming in from the South. And so that, you know, that those are at least some of the major pieces that, you know, they kind of got the ball rolling. No, it wasn't written in the law. It in the research that I've seen, evidently within the procedures through which people applied for the loans, there was a systematic, you know, it didn't say in the thing, like some of the other things talked very specifically, but it was, you know, when people came in for loan applications, the black people didn't get the loan applications, that kind of thing, which is not, you know, specifically in the law, but the practice was so, in FHA, the practice was so ingrained of discriminatory activity against blacks that they didn't get access to the process. There were evidently some that did, but there were, like I said, there were two other things that were set up specifically for black veterans, which were kind of a thing off to the side. You know, when you have that kind of, you know, like a lot of people will say today, well, why are the suburbs all white? And it's because of those kind of practices and the other restrictive covenant practices and the mortgage financing practices that, you know, blacks just didn't have access. Well, one of the things, that's right, but one of the things as part of the whole cluster of things that the Roosevelt administration did was to create the beginnings of a form of loan guarantee program that eventually developed in what we have FHA today, where as part of a spur to the economy was that if a family qualified economically for a loan, the government would guarantee the loan. Okay, but what they the trick was that the FHA appraiser went out, and if there were any black families living in the neighborhood, that lowered the possibility, you know, you lost points on your credit evaluation. And so it became very much in all white families' interest to keep blacks out because they, you know, it's like this, you know, like anything else. Essentially, black families were identified by the federal government as a form of blight. You know, and so it was in economic interest of the whites to say, hey, listen, you know, we don't want any blacks around here. Yeah, yeah. And they had no jobs, and they had, and there was no other housing available. The kind of pressure on housing, because if you think about it, what has happened in American cities, if when they defined the black zones through the restrictive covenants and populations kept growing, well, the whites started developing suburbs and moving out of the city, the blacks couldn't move. And so there were large numbers that that moved out, you know, that went back south. Those of you in Chicago, down east of Kankakee, is a place called Pembroke. Very, very interesting little community, which was one of those kind of, it's just absolutely dirt poor, but it was a thing in the, it was a place in the 1930s where some black families who were desperate to get their children safe and all that kind of stuff, they moved out into a rural environment because that was their only choice. Well, I think, you know, I think you're, what you're pointing to is you're pointing to a phenomenon that happened. At the same time, of course, there were a number of white rural people that came into the cities, that, you know, Appalachian or hillbillies. But the phenomenon I'm pointing to, and I would not argue with what you're seeing as a piece of the puzzle, but what I'm pointing to is the fact that after World War II, there were, you know, thousands and thousands of black veterans who returned, who in fact had the discipline and the financial resources, and there were thousands and thousands of middle-class black families in the cities of the North, and it was those groups that it's part of what's happened economically is that we have also seen a separation of white lower class and white working class being more in the city and white middle class and upper class going into the suburbs. And so, you know, there has been this concentration not only of uneducated lower class and working class black families, but also uneducated lower class working class whites in the city. So it's, you know, the mix has gotten serious. Yes, sir. 235 is a in the 60s and early 70s there were two programs, 235 and 236, that had to do with home purchase and with rental programs. Now, we don't have those anymore. Okay. And one of the reasons we don't have them was that the federal government, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, investigated HUD practices with the 235 housing, and it was so despicable that the U.S. Commission
essentially drove it into the ground. Because what it did was, instead of either strengthening black areas or scattering the housing, all it did was destroy additional neighborhoods. Very, very destructive practice. The 235 and 236 programs are gone. Today, we have the remnants of what's called Section 8. Section 8 is a rental program, and the effort has been in the Chicago area to make that a scattered site program, to get Section 8 rental housing scattered around the metropolis. And it has been not very successful.
Right.
Well, let me reinforce, I mean, I share that, but let me reinforce, the history I'm trying to tell you is not a history of handouts. It's a history of takeaways. That, in fact, families like us, hardworking, middle-class, family-oriented black families, for 50 years, from the 20s through the 50s, could not exercise their rights to buy houses where they think their children could be safe, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not a handout situation. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that the great tragedy we've had in this country is that we have, through federal policy and through very deliberate real estate action, we have done in countless numbers of families who, you know, whose only desire was for all the things that we desire.
I can't be accountable for my father's sins.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we got to know the history. But see, I'm not saying that at all. I mean, I don't.
That's a sad thing.
Yeah. I mean, that I do not draw that conclusion at all. I mean, my conclusion is that part of, for us to be able to deal effectively with our brothers and sisters in our society, we have to know some of the history that we have shared. And I mean, I agree, you know, I don't want to give anybody handouts. I don't want to make things, you know, do any of that kind of malarkey. But what I'm trying to show you is that we need to understand very clearly that today in the United States, we have a terribly segregated society, blacks and whites. James Farmer, wonderful old man who was a leader of the civil rights struggle in the 1960s, James Farmer said a couple weeks ago, he said, the problem is that there are so few white people that know black people, and there are so few black people that know white people, because we have ended up getting terribly segregated. Now, part of the point that I'm, part of the reason I'm here, is to say, for us to understand that tragedy of being a separated society, is to understand that did not happen by accident. That was the result of a set of specific decisions and practices that led us to the kind of dilemma that we have now. Now, I believe, and what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, is I believe that there are a number of very specific things that can be done that can really deal with, you know, kind of bridge some of those gaps. But the thing that I want to lay out to you all is that it, you know, this didn't just happen. We have done it to ourselves. I mean, you know, we're not guilty for it, but that's what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, because I believe that part of what we've had to struggle with in the society is a great deal of racial prejudice. That has been a, you know, out and out bigotry has been as American as apple pie. Now, I think we've come a tremendous way in dealing with that. And speaking as a social scientist, all the studies that are done reflect that there has been profound shift in attitudes among whites and blacks about each other, that we really have changed over the last 30 years. But I think that part of what we have to understand is that was not the case. And there are any number of things. Call it the legacy of slavery, call it the legacy of prejudice. But, a fundamental kind to me racism is too global a word. But a fundamental kind of prejudice that just permeated the society, and that just as they began to experience in World War I in the 1920s, the great movement of black families into the North, that bigotry just flipped into high gear.
And they said, we're going to control this. To some extent, it was. There are lots of, in the history of American cities, I mean, there has been, we've been prejudiced against everybody, you know. And, I'm kind of free. I'm an old Anglo-Saxon. My people have been here since the early 1700s. And so everybody's a newcomer from my perspective. But we have really always, one of the ways we have dealt with newcomers in American cities is that we've put limits on them. And up to the end of the 19th century, most of those limits were able to be gotten through. But particularly because of shifts in the economy, 19-teens and the 1920s, the conditions changed when blacks came into the city. The industrial expansion had already happened. There are a number of other economic factors. So, but that's right. And you see, up through World War I, the economy kept expanding like crazy, and so there was always room for more, and they could go up and up and up. But then the economy stops expanding, particularly in heavy industry, and then there isn't the movement that blacks have, in addition to other problems. I don't think so. I think that this is kind of history, but now I've got to speculate. In speculating, my own hunch is that one of the reasons, particularly, let me back up a little bit. When we talk about rainbow stuff around here, several people have said, we're really only talking about whites and blacks. The rainbow's a lot larger than that. Well, one of the reasons I think that we end up talking about whites and blacks is because that's that's the crunch issue in the rainbow. And that what we have had is 300 years of a white culture that has been emerging for 300 years, and we have had 300 years of a black culture emerging in the same place. And that I really believe philosophically that our issue as a people and for the churches is to figure out how it is that whites and blacks really work through and resolve the things that have separated us. And that is a much deeper issue than it is with other groups. Now, the thing that it's going to be very interesting, I may very well be wrong, because by the year 2000, the Hispanic populations combined will be a significantly larger minority group than blacks. And so it may be that if economic conditions change and if Hispanics become the largest minority group, there may be very, very heavy-duty issues. We may be seeing, with all the kind of bilingual stuff that's going on, we may be seeing just the opening salvos of some very interesting controversies. But evidently, now let me put my sociologist hat back on. The research suggests that in housing patterns, there hadn't been anything like this in terms of Hispanic settlement. That Hispanic settlement has been a much more mellow kind of thing. An interesting thing that I read recently is that any of you from Southern California? Any of you know where Garden Grove is? The Crystal Cathedral, I think, is in Garden Grove. Garden Grove has a very large Vietnamese population. And I was reading a study recently, and the patterns of discrimination against Vietnamese in housing, in their search for housing, looks amazingly like some of this stuff. And now, I don't know what that means, but reacting to your question, wow, now that's interesting, because the kind of reports, the kind of investigations have been done, so it just the same kind of dual market phenomenon. Vietnamese are shown in this area, whites are shown in that area. Let me tell you that, now, let me make a political observation. As part of my checkered career, I spent 4 years as the mayor of University Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. And my political experience, which is reinforced by my academic experience, but speaking out of the political experience, it was absolutely clear to me that the interests represented by the real estate community are diametrically opposed to the interests represented by community leadership, because the leadership of a community is interested in stability, whoever's there. If we got white people and black people and Vietnamese and Spanish, what we want is just we want a good, stable community. We want people to stay. The real estate industry makes money when property turns over. And so it is absolutely in the interest of the real estate community to have houses being sold. Now, you can either, if a community is good and solid, you can have a healthy market that turns over and it's natural and that's fine. Or you can have an unstable market that can be fostered by real estate interests, and they make a lot of money. Communities grow rich by people staying together. Real estate interests grow rich by people leaving. And that's a, you know, tomorrow afternoon I want to, there's a very interesting tension. And in my discussion tomorrow, what I want to do is look at a number of tensions in looking at issues of racial integration that can help us think through. So you're sitting in a community and you've got white families and black families, Hispanic families. How do you make that community work? And there are lots of things you can do, very practical, some of them pretty complicated. But tomorrow I want to look at some of those kind of dynamics and talk about racial integration as a positive, creative, stable experience rather than as some kind of a traditional fear. See you tomorrow.